And all of you know Richard C. Hoagland, or he wouldn't be here. But Richard is the world's foremost researcher on artifacts within our solar system. He's also the founder and principal investigator of the Enterprise mission, a research team assembled to look into the reality and implications of artifacts discovered elsewhere in our solar system. He's been a consultant to NASA, as well as science advisor to Walter Cronkite at CBS and Kevin Sanders at CNN. He is the author of The Monuments of Mars and has appeared on a number of television and radio shows, including ABC's Nightline and Art Bell. Tonight, Richard is going to clearly present evidence of intelligent life on Mars. I had the opportunity to go up last month and see Richard speak at the Pasadena event, as I imagine several of you did as well. And I hope that you come to the same conclusion I did, but the proof is in the pudding, and he's going to show you the proof, and you can make your own determination. But I think if you come to the same conclusion I did, then I think the only question left is, what do we do about it? And I think that is a question for each and every one of us. So please join me in a warm Orange County welcome for tonight's speaker, Richard C. Hoagland.
Well, when you do these things, I have discovered that Murphy flies along. And whatever can go wrong, gleefully does. We have been all afternoon since 3 o'clock putting this thing together and want for this little white cord. We sent 2 people out. We sent 1 executive and 1 attorney. The executive came back to the court. The attorney was gone for 2 hours. I don't know if that's telling us anything, but it's like those jokes about, you know, what's the difference between an elephant and something else? And you're supposed to answer the question by, well, never send an elephant to the store for peanut butter. I'm not sure why. Anyway, there is a lot going on in this very fertile field. And when Alan gently asked me after Pasadena, I mean, he asked me before, but he said, subsequent to Pasadena, would you drop down and speak at our coupon meeting? You know how some folks don't do windows? I don't do UFOs. And so this makes a very rare appearance. I am speaking tonight before, obviously, a UFO organization. The reason I know that is there's a very large rolling banner of a doom ship down here, which is not mine, all right? It's not parked out there, and I will not be leaving on it when we leave. But I felt that this was important to do, A, because, you know, I've known each other a long time, and B, because this research into artifacts, into the potential for a formerly inhabited solar system, by somebody, has now reached what I think is critical mass. And it happened in the most serendipitous way. I mean, we have been planning for years for, well, I've been working on this, it's been 15 years now, that finally, at some point, the system would cough up new pictures of the face on Mars and pyramids and Sidonia. And we thought that that new mission would be Mars Observer, and then when that disappeared in a very bizarre circumstance, we thought it would be maybe Mars Surveyor. And so we were looking forward to this fall with the insertion of the spacecraft in orbit. And then next spring when the official mission began, and many members of this far-flung kind of Sidonia family have been eagerly expecting that NASA would in fact ultimately, possibly perchance, take a picture and let us see if the damn thing is really there.
Well, I have news. It ain't going to happen. And the reason we now know and can probably prove to most objective observers' satisfaction that it's not going to happen is because of the mission that has preceded Surveyor, namely Mars Pathfinder. Because very serendipitously, on July 4th, they dropped this thing in the Martian deserts, and it began sending back all kinds of interesting stuff. And those of us who were, shall we say, a tad skeptical of the official agenda of the agency were very much concerned that there were things going on around the mission that were in keeping with things that had happened in the last 10, 20, or 30 years that most people are not aware of, having to do with mission planning and when you arrive and some things I'll explain in a little while. So we were, shall we say, predisposed to be very skeptical as to what we were going to see from Pathfinder. In fact, whether it even was going to land on Mars at the particular time that it was advertised. All that notwithstanding, what happened in the weeks following the landing was that the spacecraft sent back some, for most people, pretty astonishing images. And those images have been seen on TV screens all over the world. They have been apparently hit upon by people visiting the net, something like 200, 250 million web hits on the NASA sites that are scattered all over the world and all around the country. And by any measure, this is some indication of the enormous interest that the American people and others have in the subject of life on Mars. Because by the same token, although every time the subject of life in terms of artifacts, in terms of these things, is raised, NASA officially and in every other way says, ah, trick of light and shadow. In every press conference, in every small scientific gathering, in every official statement, somehow NASA has to mention life and Mars in the same breath. There is a remarkable paradox. It reminds me of that quote, you know, jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, but never jam today. We are forever lured to go here by the quest for life. Yet when evidence is presented, I mean, this thing does kind of look like somebody might have been alive there at some point. Oh, no. No way. This happened, of course, most recently in 1996 with the August press conference announcing The Rock. And I don't mean the Prudential Life Insurance Company. Remember the huge furor? Remember the extraordinary headlines, the discussions, the internet, the talk shows, CNN, on which I was a guest, and MSNBC and some others that had me on that day. It was an incredible day. Until you started to say, well, wait a minute. Carl, that's Dr. Sagan to other people, Carl said as far back as 1976, if we find so much as a microbe independently evolved on Mars, it will mean the galaxy teems with life. And yet not one of the correspondents and not one of the scientists and not one of the NASA officials seemed to remember what the now departed Dr. Sagan had to say. Because they looked at this rock, at these microfossils, and they said, oh, they're safely dead by 3.5 billion years. Nothing further happened. This certainly didn't indicate that anything more interesting had ever taken place on the reddish sands of Mars. And there was some incredible logical gap, at least to me, and I made a kind of a pest of myself by, you know, sitting on these TV shows and raining on their parade. You know, it's not fun when you're the only person at the party who says, wait a minute, why doesn't the emperor have anything on? You know, why is it that we're making all this fuss over something that you can't see even with an electron microscope, except if you squint, and yet we have something that's 1.5 miles long and 1,500 feet high, and we're going to have a spacecraft passing over it, in the vicinity of it, something like 40 times during the nominal mission, and nobody officially seems to care. What is wrong with this picture? So came Pathfinder. And as Jan intimated, we now have some extraordinary new evidence to put into the mix, which opens up all kinds of profound and, in some cases, disturbing questions, and in other cases, resolves mysteries that have lain in drawers and lingered on minds for years, if not decades, if not perhaps centuries themselves. Now, that's a big order to fill tonight, and I think I can follow through. I think what I'm going to be able to show you tonight is going to put those statements in proper perspective and then set us up for, as Jan appropriately termed it, the important question. What do we do now? And I have some thoughts about what we do now. And in the last hour, what I'm planning to do is go from now till around 9, and there will be all kinds of people with long hooks who will make sure that I do that. We'll then take a break for maybe 10 minutes so you can stretch and all that. Then we'll go from maybe 9:15 or so to 11. And then at 11, we're going to have some questions and discussion and kind of a round robin. We have a mic over there for people who actually want to join the conversation if you have some questions on what you've seen. So with that as prologue, let me start with a really astonishing piece of new news. I used to bug a producer in New York named Bob Jaleen when I would talk about new news. He said, Hogan, you're being redundant. It's just news, not new news. Well, Robert, it's new news. Anyway, part of the new news has to do with the fact that we're audio taping this tonight, and by the end of the evening, you're going to be able to pick up somewhere over there, I think, a copy of what you have heard and seen this evening. Now, you won't be able to get a copy of what you've seen because it's audio. However, there is a video which we're in the process of producing, and the reason that that camera is out there with that little blinking light is that we're doing what are called in the trade pickup shots. If there's something really interesting that kind of tumbles out of my mouth tonight, they will put this in the new video, and we're hoping to have it out before Christmas. It's going to be a compilation of the Phoenix Conference and Pasadena and here, and it should be pretty comprehensive, and the visuals are equally up to a task. So, with that as prologue, let me kill the slides and let me have that first video, because I want to set the stage. And the other thing I want to ask is, can we lower the house lights so that we don't have a scattering on the screen? I'm a fanatic about scatter light on screens, because I figure if you folks come and pay money, you ought to be able to see pictures without, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I'm hoping that this lighting has not too much compromised what's on over here. Not bad, all right? Okay. So, let's have the first... God gets pissed. She really is watching very carefully, all right? This is a piece of video, which gets much better, from NASA. This is the animation of the Mars Surveyor, which the night we did Pasadena, not coincidentally, was successfully placed in orbit. This is the spacecraft going over the South Polar Cap in this astonishingly good animation. The panel... antennas, not the antennas, but the solar panels are rotated, the retro rocket fired, the spacecraft took 22 minutes for that engine to break it from its interplanetary cruise to an orbit, a long looping 45-hour orbit of the planet Mars, ranging from a low point of about 250 miles to a high point of some 30-plus thousand miles, and initially it took 45 hours for the spacecraft to loop around on one single orbit. Now, as many of you probably know, this spacecraft is unique in the space program in that it is the first operational use of a technique called aerobraking, where without further use of main rocket engines, the spacecraft is deliberately aimed through the lower atmosphere, actually the upper atmosphere of Mars at about 150 miles altitude, and the air resistance on the panels and the spacecraft, which is depicted very nicely in this computer graphic, literally subtracts on each pass through that upper atmosphere a little bit of energy and causes the orbit to shrink. And again, in this beautiful animation, which NASA can do, I mean, they can do astonishing things when they want to, you can see how the orbit shrinks on every pass through the aerobraking, and this is called a Holman transfer, and it steals energy at the low point, and then it shows up at the high point. And finally, in about 3 or 4 months, it's supposed to be relatively circular at 378 kilometers above the surface of Mars. And I think this is some approach video that was shot with a TV camera. Keep this in mind. I'm going to come back to this in a second. Now, what they've done is they've moved it around in the computer so you can actually see what Mars would look like rotating if you were coming in face on. But see, of course, you're not. You're coming in from the side. So the computer, of course, can correct for that, computer graphics. These are real images of Mars rotating in front of Mars Surveyor as it approached in August. And it's pretty astonishing as to what this technology can do. This is the spacecraft, I believe, at the Cape, with the solar panels all folded up and the instrumentation up on top here. There's a spectrometer. There's the camera, very long focal length telescope with a CCD camera. There's other various instrumentation. There's a magnetic field detector, which is actually something I'm going to talk about in a minute. This spacecraft, as you know, is the replacement for Mars Observer, which was lost mysteriously in 1993, and it carries about half of the complement of instruments that the original Mars Observer mission was supposed to carry to Mars. And it's pretty neat. It's going to tell us an awful lot, provided, of course, that the guys who are running the instruments decide to tell us what it is they really find. And it seems astonishing to me, after 30-some years in the space biz, at museums and networks and other places, to have to qualify now every statement about what NASA's finding by the phrase, if they decide to tell us. This is not the space program that I ever signed on for. This is not the kind of country that I thought I lived in, where the most important stuff, which we're all paying for, is simply locked away, and they give us something else. But in fact, as you're going to see this evening, that, unfortunately, is exactly what we have. Now, this is the laser altimeter, which fires during the experimental passes, and is going to give us the topography under the spacecraft. And this is, again, a computer graphic representation of what that looks like. There is also something called a thermal emission reflectometer, which has to do with measuring magnetic fields. And there's some infrared. This is the actual magnetic experiment, which is looking not only at the possible presence of a magnetic field around Mars, but also is looking at the interaction of the magnetic field with the solar wind, this array of particles. This is the actual launch footage. I was at Cape Canaveral when the spacecraft was launched in November of 1996. This is the liftoff of the Delta with its solid fuel cluster motors here and the core central stage in the center. Out over the Atlantic, and I think this is the... All right, so we can cut the video. We're not going to bring on John just yet, all right? What do I want? Give me the slides back, please, okay? And put in the second tape and just... If you've taken the tab out, don't let it play, all right? A friend of mine said, you know, you don't have the tabs taken out of those videos. They could be erased. So, of course, he very nicely took out all the tabs. So when you put them in now, they just... Which is why I didn't have the tabs taken out. I suddenly remembered. That's... Anyway. Two things. The Mars Surveyor mission already has achieved an astonishing new discovery. How many here remember, about a week after orbital insertion on September 11th, a little thing in the LA Times, I guess out here, or maybe the Register or one of the other papers, where they were discussing the discovery of the Martian magnetic field? Anybody remember seeing that? I can't see. You're all just sitting there. Okay. There were two properties of the field which were very important. One was, remember that long looping orbit that went like that? The only way you can measure the field is when it was right close to Mars, because field strength varies as the inverse cube of distance. It's kind of like tides. So you can only really measure the field as it whips around and goes through the atmosphere and then comes back up. Now, eventually, when the orbit is circular, they'll be able to measure the magnetic field all during the orbit, and because they're in a polar orbit and the planet is rotating underneath, they'll measure the field over all parts of Mars. But for now, they're only measuring in a few minutes as it whips around at that low point. And when they go up to the high point, of course, the field strength falls off, and they can't really detect anything. There have been all kinds of previous missions to Mars. There were the Soviet missions in the 70s. There was the Mariner 9 mission in 1971. There were the Vikings in 1976. None of these missions was able to measure, American or Soviet, any detectable, reproducible magnetic field. The first report of a magnetic field of Mars, which in itself was anomalous, that none of these prior missions had measured a field, now has given us a value of something like 1/800th of the strength of the magnetic field that is currently passing through this room, the Earth's magnetic field. The other piece of data, which came out a few days later, was that the field did not appear to be uniform or quasi-uniform like the Earth, but in fact appeared to be incredibly lumpy. It was concentrated in little pockets, and the orientation of the pockets, you know, north-south dipole kind of stuff, was not aligned. In other words, they were all randomly oriented, and the field strength in those pockets was much higher than the 1/800th of the half a gauss, I believe, of the Earth's field that we're experiencing at this moment in this room. The reason this is such an extraordinary and exciting discovery is because it is tantamount to a total confirmation of Tom Van Flandern's model for the origin of Mars. Now, this is going to be a little complicated because I don't have the graphics, and it wouldn't do me any good if I did, because it's hard to describe something like this without waving your arms, so I'll wave my arms. In 1912, a very interesting physicist named Arthur Schuster gave a paper before the Royal Society of England in which he stated, based on two data points, one, the measurement of the Earth's magnetic field right here using instruments, gadgets, and the other, a newly invented technique by George Ellery Hale at the Mount Wilson Observatory, which is up the street, up above Pasadena, up in the mountains at Mount Wilson, for measuring magnetic fields of the sun, called the Zeeman splitting. Using those two data points, the field strength of the Earth from in situ measurements, measurements with instruments right here, and remote sensing using spectroscopic techniques of the sun from the Snow telescope up at Mount Wilson in 1912, Schuster presented this very remarkable paper before the Royal Philosophical Society in that year. And what he stated was that the magnetic field of a body, a planet, is only dependent on one parameter, something called total angular momentum. If I have an object, all right, and I know the mass, and I know the size of it, all right, and I know how fast it's spinning, there are very simple textbook kind of equations involving something called the moment of inertia that allow me to calculate for a given mass and size, and shape is kind of in there, but for a spherical planet, it's really simple, the total momentum of the spin. Angular momentum is like linear momentum. If I throw a ball at a certain speed, it has a certain momentum. If I'm spinning the ball at a certain speed, it has another equivalent momentum, depending upon the rate of spin and the mass of the ball, i.e. planet. What Schuster said was that the magnetic field of the Earth and the Sun appeared to lie on a straight line. If this is a graph, if this is the x-axis, this is in the y, then you could plot a straight line at about a 45-degree angle, and you could put the Earth and the Sun on that straight line. And he predicted that as astronomers measured the fields of other bodies in space, other planets around the Sun, other stars in the Milky Way, maybe even the Milky Way itself someday if it had a field, and of course he hadn't a clue at that point, 1912, there was no way to measure the magnetic field of the Milky Way galaxy. He predicted that what would happen is that all of these data points for the magnetic fields would fall on this straight line. It's now 1997. And some, let's see, 80, 90 years after he made this prediction, science has now been able to measure magnetic fields of astronomical bodies over 35 orders of magnitude. That's one followed by 34 zeros. And guess what? All of these objects, without exception, conform exquisitely to Arthur Schuster's equation. His prediction. The total magnetic field strength, the total energy of the magnetic field, seems to be dependent only on this one property of a spinning object, its angular momentum. That was the basis in 1989 for Torin and my prediction of the field strength, the total energy of the field of Neptune before the Voyager spacecraft arrived. Everybody else at NASA was thinking it was going to be much greater than it turned out to be, and we, using Schuster's equation, were coming in much below. We actually, I think, put this on the primitive version of the web in our CompuServe conference at that time, and so we got in about 2 weeks before the spacecraft got there our number for what the field strength would be, as well, by the way, as the orientation, the actual polarity of the field. We were right on that, too. this is not bad. I mean, science is supposed to be prediction. Well, why? What does all this have to do with Mars? Well, the fact that Mars is a planet of a given mass, it's about 1/11th, I believe, of the mass of the Earth, if my memory serves, and it seems to have an iron core and a mantle and a rocky crust and all that, as noted by other observations from the Pathfinder mission and Vikings before. But the fact that it has this incredibly weak field, yet it rotates in slightly less than 24 hours. I mean, 24 hours, 37 minutes, all right, slightly more than, is an incredible anomaly. And now, from the Surveyor mission, we have a number for the field, and it's 1/800th of the field strength of the Earth. Now, the reason I'm taking a long time to do this is because I want to show you how you can get stunning breakthroughs without seeing one new picture. And then I'm going to tell you something political which is going on, which is, to me, kind of confirmation that we're on the right track. Because you see, what the field strength of Mars seems to indicate is that somehow in its own past, Mars did not rotate at 24 hours, 37 minutes like it does now, but in fact has a total magnetic field equivalent to a body of its mass and size spinning once every few days. So here's the question. How in the world can a slowly rotating body orbiting at that distance from the sun, which is slightly more than the Earth, about 1.5 times farther out than the Earth, how can such an object in any plausible scenario get sped up so it's now rotating in slightly more than 24 hours? It just, in any known astrophysics, it simply cannot happen. Which, of course, gets me really intrigued. Because when you're looking at things that say no in current physics, I, of course, immediately look to hyperdimensional physics to see if there might be an answer over there. And in fact, you don't have to invoke that, although it is involved, because the reason Schuster's equation works, we now know, is because of the hyperdimensional physical model. It's a very elegant connection, which will be laid out in great detail in the new book. Yes, there is going to be a new book, hopefully out next year. It's going to be called The Heritage of Mars, Awakening Forever. And we'll have lots of clues in there speaking to that title. So how do we resolve this puzzle, this conundrum? Well, it's very simple. Because Tom Van Flander, remember him? He and I have been talking now for several years regarding his model of earlier events in the solar system. Earlier events which in fact seem strongly now to suggest that the system that we see is not the system that was once here. That in fact there may be one or more totally missing worlds, planets. And that what we see is the comets and the asteroids, these rings of objects circling the sun, or these Burgi bits that are flying in very looping orbits around the sun that kind of come into our ken every few years and, like Hale Bopp, get all the media very excited. That both of these classes of objects are in fact debris from formerly exploded worlds, the detonation of entire planets by processes currently unknown, that have removed most of the material from the solar system completely and left the residuum in very interesting orbits, which allows Tom, who is a dynamicist, that's a guy that works with orbits, that's what he did at the Naval Observatory, he was a premier celestial mechanics expert working with orbits, to basically reel the clock backward and figure out what happened. Well, Tom and I have been discussing the fact that in that model, Mars may not have been an independent planet of the solar system at all, but in fact at one time may have been a moon of another body orbiting roughly where the asteroids now exist, roughly 2.5 times as far from the sun as we are. Now, how do you test such an idea? Well, one of the predictions is that if this bigger planet, and the constraints of the model say it maybe had four or five times the mass of the Earth. It was not a gas giant. It wasn't like a Jupiter or Saturn. It was a rocky world. If it was orbited by Mars and maybe another moon, then there's a certain range of orbits which would kind of fit with such an astrophysical model. And that range of orbits predicts that a Mars as a moon of this now vanished world would orbit the planet with a period of a few days. And because of tidal interactions, the so-called synchronous effect, like Earth's moon, which orbits in a month, it would most likely have kept one face, one hemisphere, oriented toward this vanished primary, and one side eternally away. So it would have rotated on its axis. I'll do it with this. Rotated on its axis in the same period as it orbited this hypothetical giant primary planet. In other words, the prediction is that Mars naturally would have been tidally locked into a rotational period, if it ever was a moon, a satellite, and not a primary planet, of a few days. And the concomitant prediction, a la Schuster, and the hyperdimensional model, is that if that situation were in fact true, then when it cooled and the processes of interior planetary energy production and all that took place, its field would have been established by its spin, by its hyperdimensional environment, which in fact is what's going on, and that field would have reflected that slow period of rotation once every few days. So then the planet that it orbits somehow mysteriously explodes. And by the way, the time frame for that, Tom now believes, is at the 65 million year range. Gosh, what happened 65 million years ago? Did something happen? Anybody know Steven Spielberg's number? Okay. And in the process, if your primary planet explodes, it's kind of like, you know, where are you going to go? The planets that were formerly moons would now have been released into their own orbits of the sun. And again, Tom is the expert, and he has shown me elegantly that, in fact, Mars' elliptical orbit, it is the most elliptical of the major planets, save Pluto, of course, fits perfectly into this scenario of a world that's quietly minding its own business one day, and its big guy next door blows up. And where are you going to go? Well, you wander around in a kind of a drunken orbit of the sun until things stabilize and settle down a bit. And this, of course, answers all kinds of neat, weird, wondrous questions, including where those so-called Martian meteorites that they keep picking up in the Antarctic really came from. Maybe they're not from Mars. Maybe they're from the exploded planet. Maybe we're not looking at little Martian bugs at all. But, of course, since the mainstream guys aren't giving Tom the time of day and wouldn't know an interesting, novel, testable theory if they fell over it, they're not thinking that there's anything missing in the solar system, so they think these things have to come from Mars. Well, that's another story. The point is that this one new set of data, which came in 1 week after the Mars Surveyor spacecraft was successfully placed in orbit, seems to be a stunning, resounding confirmation of Van Flandern's model, that Mars was once a former moon of a much bigger silicate-type planet. And if that is true, then what it harbinges for all the scenarios of life, of colonization, of what may have happened in this galactic soap opera we've been looking at for 15 years now, is completely and fascinatingly transformed. Because it is conceivable that the guys who colonized Mars did not come from some other solar system, and they may not have come from Earth. They may have come from the primary planet which Mars orbited, which of course then puts new time horizons and time constraints on this scenario. So this is a non-trivial discovery. Now the other thing that the spacecraft discovered, which is that all over Mars there appears to be this kind of... let me have the next slide, all right? Actually, I can do it up here, right? Yes, yes. Yep, yep. Well, you know, this technology business is kind of complicated. I don't know whether I'm up to it here. Okay. You've all seen this, and this, and this, and this. Am I going fast enough, Alan? And this, and this. I'm going to get to something here. We'll come back to these things in a minute. I want to get to one little guy, which is right about... We're coming up on it, all right? Coming up on it. Nope, not Olympus. There we are. Okay. This is Mars, all right? Mars has a very curious asymmetry between the two hemispheres. The northern hemisphere is basically very flat and almost featureless. In fact, the laser altimeter people have now been reporting from the low passes that there are incredibly flat plains that go for thousands of miles and are as flat as a tabletop, and they can't understand how this occurs. Mars has flatter places than anywhere else in the entire solar system now, according to the laser altimeter looking down and basically doing like that. All right? The southern hemisphere, by contrast, is incredibly lumpy and pockmarked, and it's got all these huge craters and small craters and medium-sized craters, and, you know, is basically a dog's breakfast of all kinds of stuff that seems to have happened to the southern hemisphere and not happened to the north. And the line between the north and southern hemisphere, where this is, in fact, I think it's more like this, all right, on this photograph, is roughly 35 degrees to the current equator, all right? And that, in Dom Van Flandern's model, is evidence that it's the southern hemisphere which got hit when the planet that Mars orbited, when it was a moon in a former life, blew up. It basically got splattered with the shrapnel, all right? Now, this is very interesting because we know from our observations of the moon, the NASA observations, that there are regions of the moon, which has basically no magnetic field either, that does have very local weird concentrations of magnetic field, which has confounded all standard theories. And the explanation that was eventually proposed was that these local concentrations of magnetic field strength on the moon were caused by asteroid or cometary impact. In the physics of an impact, there is generated a phenomena called a plasma. It's basically an incredibly seizingly hot gas. The energy of impact is transformed into heating the material, both of the body that's hit and the object which is hitting it. And in that moment, any fields are magnified, like an amplifier. And then when the rock or the material cools, that magnified field is like frozen in. It's like magnetic tape. It basically is a magnetic signature of a magnetic effect which is amplified in that brief instant when the explosion occurs. It is very tempting to conclude that what Surveyor has now measured in terms of the lumpiness and random orientation of the microstructure of the fields as it zips around close to the planet is in fact the lumpiness associated with the impacts of the iron-nickel core of the primary planet as the darn thing blew up. And all of these fragments raced outward at several miles per second until they encountered an impeding object, i.e. Mars, and went splat. I mean, the image, I can't wait to get the computer graphics people in Hollywood and have them do this the way they can do it. Can you imagine what that would look like? Can you just imagine what that incredible widescreen panorama would be when we get to the point where we know enough to actually talk to these people and get them to do it? Again, Surveyor appears to have given us vital new information in the first few hours of its mission that has confirmed a major important set of data. Now, I say appears because this is science, at least it's supposed to be. And what we have to do, of course, is to wait until the orbit is circular and we're measuring fields all over the planet at the same strength. And then we look and see whether there's an asymmetry between the northern hemisphere fields and the southern hemisphere. Is all the lumpiness associated with the southern hemisphere, which is all where all the craters are and where the debris is presumed to have hit? In other words, there are ways to test these ideas which will tell us if, in fact, this scenario is right. Well, guess what? a few days ago, our friends in our friendly local neighborhood space agency, NASA, withdrew their estimate of the low magnetic field. They said, whoops, made a mistake. Nope, it's not there. We can't tell you what it is, but it's not there. We don't know what we're talking about. We blew it. We were too premature. We were too excited. You know, we're not really measuring the local field. Which, of course, has me instantly suspicious. Now, I wonder why I'm so suspicious. Because, you see, this is the same agency that would not give us incredible detailed close-ups of the core of Hale-Bopp, which would have stunningly confirmed Van Flandern in a totally different manner. Now, I am strongly suspecting that somewhere on high, the folks that know the real history of the solar system and know exactly what happened and know what to expect at Mars because that's why we're there, they have communicated down the chain, down the pyramid, to the honest folks, the guys who were just doing the science, and said, you shouldn't have said that. You know, retract it. Tell them you made a mistake. Tell them you have to work on it some more. In other words, we're looking at another potential cover-up of crucial, new, critically important information. Now, the antidote to that, of course, is what we're going to do is that we're going to put a prediction, a kind of a summation of what I've just said, on the web. And we're going to hope that the honest people, the ones in NASA who are just doing the measurements, the ones that simply read out the computers and, you know, do the grunt work in the trenches, the graduate students, that they will read the web and they will look at these numbers and they will look at what their bosses or whoever's telling them to change things are saying, and they will get fed up. They will understand, maybe, because now we don't have to wait for the scientific journals. We have an independent, non-censorable communications technology called the World Wide Web. And we're going to find out whether it actually is useful as more than the most expensive party line in the world. Well, that is a very long setup. I'm sorry, Alan, but I wanted to, you know, set up the rest of the evening because based on this new information, the pictures I'm going to show you now from Pathfinder are so remarkable in their own right that they add new dimension to this story. And let me tell you how we're going to do this, all right? What I need is the computer. Can I have the computer, please? Down there. Projector off and computer on. And this is the smiling face of my friend John Holloman at CNN, whose voice you heard briefly. Now, when we were in Pasadena, what I did was I showed several long minutes of video which had been put together from CNN's coverage of the landing of Pathfinder on Mars. John looks a tad green. It's probably because he takes a while to warm up. All right. We're not going to do that tonight, all right? What I will do, however, is to show you this because I want to explain a little bit of a process which allowed us to literally peek behind the scenes at NASA and, in fact, allowed us to begin to unravel what was really going on. During the landing, we were running lots and lots of video. Here's a monitor sitting next to John, and what he would do during the whole mission is he would basically come on when anything twitched, any photograph came back, any little rover hiccup, you know, the poor thing getting stuck on a rock and all that, and he would do a stand-up piece, or he would do a special. They had one called The Little Rover That Could, which was kind of cute. And what we did was we taped these things. Now, what I need to show you now is how, in fact, we taped them, because this is another part of the process. What we did is we simply hooked up the VCR to the television system, and what will come up here in a moment is a schematic of the long path length of the data as it came back from Mars. All right, and we'll do this, and we'll do that. All right, and I'll grab that little guy, and we'll then do this. Okay, the path was like this. We have a Pathfinder sitting on Mars. It transmits on a very low signal, 20 watts or so, to the various ground antennas of the Deep Space Network, which are managed by NASA, actually by JPL for NASA. It's then processed, these signals in the computer, sent up to a communication satellite, one of several that NASA rents space on, and then sent down to the Goddard Space Flight Center, where it's sent back up to the communication satellites, and then places like CNN or local television affiliates or cable stations or whatever can basically just capture the feed. And even local people with satellite dishes can aim their satellite dish at a communication satellite in the sky and get a feed from NASA and see live pictures from Mars. And we recorded several sets of them as they came in. What we then did was, using a device like this, this is just, you know, a off-the-shelf, run-of-the-mill laptop computer, we were able to grab individual frames, all right, and store them as digital images from the analog signal sent out by CNN based on the live downlink of data coming all the way from Mars. And this is critical, because this live signal, unlike the Mars surveyor images, which will come to us in about 6 months, we are told, this live signal, in fact, really was live. For a few minutes on the evening of July 4th, as this spacecraft sat on the surface of Mars, in fact, I think I can go closer here and show you this picture, all right, we had breaking news, live pictures from the planet Mars. And these live pictures, which in fact were initially, we were told by people like Donna Shirley, only supposed to be of a limited area around the lander, showing airbags and solar panels and things like that. In fact, these live pictures revealed so much more, because for some reason, NASA got a lot more imagery in that first downlink than it ever imagined it would. And of course, this raises a profound question, because no less an authority than Donna Shirley, who was the head of the Mars Exploration Program for all of NASA, based at JPL, she sat on CNN, and I have her on tape if, in case anybody wants to hear that, and she predicted confidently that, oh, there are only going to be a few postage stamp-sized pictures, and the real good stuff would not come in for hours after it had been, you know, downlinked by computer and, in fact, had been properly massaged and presented to computers for analysis and all that. Well, in fact, in those first few minutes, the digital images behind the display that I'm showing you now, this is a frame, I'm sorry, this is a mosaic called 80881, which in fact is the first mosaic from Mars. And it's composed of little individual pictures pasted together, obviously not very well here, in the computer. Notice the gap in the horizon, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. All right? This, of course, was when the camera was in the stowed position. The camera had two positions, kind of squat down, and then when they released certain latches, it would spring up, rotating to a height of maybe 4 or 5 feet higher. And this was in the stowed position before the rover had been deployed. Notice the bubbling airbags here. This airbag was the thing that was preventing them from driving off the lander. So a lot of time was spent in that first few hours worrying about this lander and how to get it off the rover. And then out in the distance, of course, you see these things. We're going to talk about these in detail in a couple of minutes. But anyway, what we saw on TV was not the couple of pictures that NASA had initially been expecting, but in fact, at least 100 or more of the frames comprising that initial panorama that all came in under the political umbrella that NASA itself had advertised and had staked its reputation upon, i.e. live TV. Now, why did they do that? How did somebody open this door and let all kinds of interesting stuff through this gate? Because beginning in 93, we had made, and others had made, a great fuss of the fact that Mars Observer pictures were, in essence, going to be censored for the first time in NASA's history. That we had been to all these other places all over the solar system. Moon, you know, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, you know, Galilean moons, all those places. And we'd seen pictures live. I mean, I used to sit in the cafeteria up the street at JPL and have lunch watching live pictures coming in from Jupiter. It was the most incredible experience to be sitting there and watching a place a half a billion miles away while you're eating your whatever. I don't remember what I was eating, because I was frankly not very interested in what I was eating. I was watching, you know, these live pictures, as was everybody else. I mean, it's like, you know, one of these Twilight Zone things where everybody's kind of freeze frame with their forks up, you know. I mean, one picture after another, each one more incredible and more bewildering and more remarkable than the last. And like all these people who, of course, worked at JPL, sitting there with their forks suspended, forgetting what was on the tray, just looking at these monitors at something that no human being, we thought then, had ever seen before. Yes, John, yes. Okay. Anyway, so on Mars Observer in 93, they weren't supposed to do that. They decided suddenly, oh no, we're that, you know, the technology now has gotten so good, we have to wait 6 months to show you anything. Come again? What? Oh yeah, and we're going to set up these kiosks at the Smithsonian and at a couple of museums, and people can fly in from all over the country and stand in long lines to see pictures of Mars. Well, wait a minute. You know, we got this thing called the web. We've got cable. We've got CNN. You mean I can't sit at home and watch live TV? No. Technology is much too advanced now. It will take us years to process these pictures. They're so super. Well, have you looked at the web? Anyway. So something was wrong with this picture. So we made a big fuss about it. And we said, NASA's hiding something. No live TV. They're hiding something. Well, to show us up, I mean, let's be honest, they thought they really had figured it out. They would show us live TV. Now, they plan to show us little bitty-witty squares right around the airbags. Nothing should pop up. No little Martians crawling over the airbags, all right? It would be safe. Yet, politically, it would be one up from, see, live TV, we're not hiding anything. Hovind, go away, all right? Well, Donna Shirley is standing there, and suddenly, instead of one or two little pictures, picture after picture after picture, and these stunning, remarkable live frames of panoramas and these distant vistas, and it was obvious that this was not planned. Now, remember Jurassic Park? We're back to Spielberg. Remember the mad programmer? The guy over in the corner who ate all the candy bars and, you know, drank all that soda? I don't remember what it was. The guy who really was the problem for Jurassic Park? Well, think of an equivalent guy somewhere on the Pathfinder computer team who, instead of only programming the couple three images they were going to give us live, he decides, for whatever reason, that what he's going to do is simply tell the damn computer, photograph the whole damn scene and send it down. And that's what happened. And that is the only reason I am standing here tonight, because on this frame, 80881, we have found, with our geologist Ron Nix, and now several other geologists are joining us there. I have to tell you the story, all right? I must tell you the story, and I can't tell you who said it, because I'm using this as blackmail. All right? If this geologist does not turn state's evidence and put his analysis on the web soon, I'm going to post what he said with his attribution. Let me tell you what happened. Ron Nix has worked with this guy. Ron Nix is a geologist that worked with Parsons, with the Department of Energy. He's an engineering geologist. I mean, he's been the one who on our team has looked at this and was the first to say, holy, this is not normal. There's something really weird here. I can't find a rock. There's junk out there. It looks like a factory floor. And he, you know, we had a tape made. He was supposed to be in Pasadena, and he had a family problem, so we had a tape made, and we ran the tape. And his comments now are in the form of a posting on the web, and he's about to do another one as part of a series of his geological analysis of the so-called monuments of Mars. Well, he has a friend, very good friend, and they've known each other like 10 or 15 years. They work together at this major engineering firm, and the other day Ron was contacted to consult for this other firm, and of course, he said yes. I mean, money is money. So he walks in, and he starts talking about what we've been doing and the Pathfinder stuff, and his friend, who has been taping and recording off the Pathfinder website in the computer there at the company, pops up on a monitor almost as big as this screen one of the Pathfinder images. In fact, let me show you. Let me try to go and grab the image if I can find it here. All right. Sometimes these things get really stacked up, so we'll have to see. See, I could cut off the screen so you didn't see anything, but I won't do that. I believe, here we are. This is from Goddard. This is from the Goddard Space Flight Center. All right. NASA has squirreled away this data all over the planet. All right. And I do this. There we are. Okay. Now I want this back. Okay. This is one of the pictures that we're going to get into in a little while. Anyway, this individual looks at this. This is one of the first color partial mosaics. And he looks, for instance, over here. All right. Now, notice the problem with this picture. Let me grab this. All right. Is there a problem with this picture? All right. I mean, we've got pretty good imaging here, although, you know, I can take better pictures with a brownie. And then over here, oh, my God, $150 million down the drain. What are we going to do? These guys don't know how to stitch. You've heard that expression, a stitch in time saves nine? Well, they don't even have one. Something is radically wrong. So this geologist takes one look at this. I mean, he has known nothing about what we're basically talking about. He simply is looking at this picture, at this particular part of this panorama. Let me back down here so you can see the context, all right? See how everything is nicely registered in color over here? And yet over here, they just kind of lost it. You know, you got to stop trying to train these chimps to run computers. Their fingers are too big for the keys. All right? There's something happened between here and here. And I'll show you in a minute what happened, all right? He looks at this, and he says, oh, my God, what are they doing? And then he says to my friend, somebody ought to do something. Yes? He didn't say, I ought to do something. He said, somebody ought to do something. Because, of course, he's not a dumb person. He is a person who, in this engineering firm, is the geologist in charge of the computer display systems. And this company is very big. It's like Bechtel or, you know, one of these big, big guys. And it literally has contracts all over the world. So this is a very responsible individual who knows a deliberate weirdness of display when he sees it. And his reaction was, my God, somebody ought to do something. Because he understands that this is deliberate. It's not accidental. It's not a fault of the programming. It's not because, you know, they had a glitch in the stitching program. It is a deliberate effort at obfuscation of something in this scene that we are not supposed to notice. So, this individual is being coaxed between basketball, you know, carpooling, kids need new shoes, contracts, car payments, the dog broke its leg. I mean, no, the daughter broke her leg. The dog needed to have shots, all right? I mean, all of these things of life intrude on this individual who, by the way, over 2 or 3 years ago, wrote a very impassioned letter to Dan Golden decrying the fact that the Cydonia geology does not match what NASA says, and waited over a year before he got a response, and only got a response because he involved his local congressman, who happened to have just been elected head of the Budget Committee in the so-called Republican Revolution in 1994. In other words, this is not someone who's not paying attention. This is someone who is paying attention, who understands instantly. I mean, he hadn't been paying attention to Pathfinder because, well, they're going to land in the middle of this stupid river valley and there's nothing there. The real excitement is over in Cydonia and not going anywhere near Cydonia, so why bother to even look? Until my friend Ron dragged him over to the computer and said, look at this. And he says, oh, my God, somebody ought to do something. But not I ought to do something. So, see, I've been puzzled. This web thing is really puzzling me because we live in a very sophisticated society. We live in a planet now where you can talk to anyone in just like that, instance. They're called cell phones. You can send faxes. You can send data. You can send email. You can wake people up in the middle of the night, which sometimes I tend to do. You can be in touch anywhere on Earth or over Earth or under Earth or out at sea. No one is immune now from information overload. So what NASA's been doing in terms of their 250 million web hits means that an awful lot of people have looked at this. And you mean to tell me that this geologist, as a technically competent person, a person of Silicon Valley quality, a person of IBM quality, of AT&T quality, of Sony quality, in other words, you guys out there, you mean to tell me that he's the only one that looks at this and says, holy cow, somebody ought to do something with the parentheses because they're scamming us like crazy. And yet, is there any general uprising in the American scene, on the web, on the networks, in Congress, over the fact that we have gone here and they're obviously hiding something? No. Which, of course, makes me wonder, what is the use of the web? What's the missing factor? It's not that people aren't seeing this. There's something else in the equation. And that something else, unless we figure it out, means that there'll be little groups like us here tonight looking at this stuff and saying, oh my God, somebody ought to do something. And nothing will get done. And of course, I'm not content with that. We have, for the last 15 years, been pursuing a set of objectives, which is that this government will somehow, in terms of the space program, which is the part of the government that I know, will somehow return to constitutional authority and give the power back to the people to figure out what's there and what they need to do about it. That's what the document says. And something has radically gone wrong. It has intervened. And what's happening is that good men and women are looking at this and they're saying, oh my God, somebody ought to do something. And yet there isn't a ripple in the mainstream. And I guarantee you this individual is not the only one. So what's the missing puzzle piece? Is it that if in fact what we're seeing here, and I'm going to go on now, if it implies what it seems to imply, does it in fact mean that not only in terms of the space program, that shining equivalent of Ronald Reagan's City on the Hill, which everyone is so proud of. It's like, if you can't trust that, if that finally falls, along with Nixon and the tapes and all the other stuff, is there anything left to believe in? And I think that is one of the major hang-ups to not only resolving this issue, but also resolving the UFO problem as well. It's like, at some point, people simply give up and they do not really want to know. Because to know, to really find out how much they're being lied to about things that everybody automatically assumes they would be told if it were true. I mean, if I had a dime for every person that says to me, but wait a minute, this would be a gold card for NASA. If there were artifacts on Mars, if there was once a civilization, of course they would tell us. It'd be unlimited, you know, money from Congress. We would just, you know, pay them to go and find out for us. To which I have evolved another answer now after doing this for 15 years. Because, turn it around. In human experience, in everyday life, or in the long course of history, all that stuff we were forced to read about, all those dates and all those people that did all those terrible things to all those other people, when something is deemed incredibly important, when has such knowledge and information been freely given to anyone at any time? And yet the mantra for the last, you know, 30-some years since NASA was formed is that if ET existed and ET phoned NASA, NASA would turn around and tell all the rest of us that they got the phone call. And in fact, it is precisely the opposite. And the question in my mind is only now, how many people really believe this mythology? How many people really understand that this, above all things, is the thing that would have and must be hidden from all of us? And the reason is so simple. Because it is so incredibly valuable. And how do we know it's valuable? Because if it were true and on the boards, everything would change. And there are folks, some of them may be here tonight, who don't want change. They're happy and comfortable, and making it good with the way things now exactly are. And the only mechanism that government hangs on to is prevention of change. That's how the Egyptians lasted for 3,000 years. They didn't allow change. In our society, we have this incredible mythology that changes our profession, that everything around us is changing. In fact, if you really start analyzing, I was talking with Jan this afternoon over lunch. I'm flying in the same 747 that I flew in back when we went to the moon, 30-some years ago. Do you know there are books and documents and studies which were predicting, based on evolution curves of transportation and speeds and velocities, that by now we would exceed the speed of light if you just extrapolate the numbers? We have hit some kind of glass ceiling, and over the last several decades, except for the equivalent of tail fins, there has really been no fundamental technological or scientific change. And you look at this and you say, wait a minute, what has intervened in the course of this incredible experiment called the United States of America, where change used to be our profession, to where now we are content to give lip service to change? And when it comes to this incredible new tool, the one new thing which has been brought on in the last 30 years, which is this computer, what do we find? We find Janet Reno, you know, duking it out with Bill Gates, which is insane. I mean, Gates and Microsoft are responsible for more fundamental information change than any other single factor on this planet, and he's the guy she's now targeting. Gosh, I wonder what side she's on. And I'm not a... You know, I have no stock with Bill Gates. I'd like to, but I don't. Anyway, so we're getting far afield. Let me show you some images here, because this will kind of prove my point. All right. So we'll go back to this, and let me tell you what we did. We started looking on the basis of some really weird stuff that was going on around the mission. I mean, I was with CBS and then with some other news media some 20 years ago when we first went to Mars in Project Viking. And I remember sitting there day after day in the press conferences. Remember, the technology was 20 years more primitive, so we're told. And I remember the miracles they kept pulling off. And every single day, we got data. In this mission, how many times have we heard, whoops, just didn't phone home. We didn't quite get to come in at the right time. You know, we really don't know how fast Mars rotates. You know, we got this problem with this temperature. I mean, they have given us incredible excuses for why communication with this mission has been so off and on and hit and miss, and maybe, possibly, perchance, well, tomorrow, it might, well, we can't really guarantee, but, you know, we'll get some pictures someday. I have never seen a NASA mission in 30-some years of covering and scrutinizing and, in fact, being part of a couple of them that has been so screwed up. Or a press corps that has no sense of history and literally doesn't understand that this can't happen. Look, you got a spacecraft sitting on a planet. Planet rotates in 24 hours, 37 minutes. You can set your watch by that. You've got a distance between Earth and Mars. We know that distance. We know the speed of light. You can actually do a little calculation. Why, we've got these little gadgets called computers. Remember those? We can actually figure out, if I send a signal now, it will get to Mars in 10 minutes, 9 seconds, 0.2397336. In other words, nothing is unknown here. So how come we're missing these windows? How come the spacecraft doesn't talk to us? How come we sent the data and, oh, it wasn't really woken up and it wasn't really, didn't have its coffee yet and it was, you know, kind of grumpy and, I mean, give me a break. And yet, my dear colleagues, at places like here, they don't seem to have a clue. Now, I have not, in all honesty, had a chance to sit down with John Holloman and look him in the eye and say, John, what the hell is going on? Do you really buy this malarkey? You can't have any historical memory. This is the, you know, Cats and Yammer Kids and Keystone Cops. This is not a real mission. There's something wrong, and maybe you should watch. I mean, anytime you're putting on the headlines the rock named Scooby-Doo, watch out. I mean, my conclusion based on this is that there are folks on this mission who basically have tried between the lines to tell us, yes, folks, it is a cartoon. This is not the real mission. All right? So we started asking questions. I started looking at these pictures, and I realized that we had this incredible database, which is these live images that came in those first few minutes that were completely uncensored. So what we started to do, is we started to add these images up in the computer and perform some fairly simple, you know, routines using some programs that everybody has access to and a couple that you don't have access to. We went to Canada a couple, 3 years ago, and for about $1,000 were able to procure a copy of the algorithm used to deblur the Hubble images by NASA itself. So we have some fairly sophisticated tools, and because of Bill Gates, you know, we've got the technology to run these tools, these programs on, and we can compete with NASA itself in terms of imaging. This is not, pardon the pun, rocket science. It is Shannon information theory. It's in a completely separate domain over here. And, you know, Big Blue is responsible in part for some of this. I have to give her that credit because Jan paid me a lot of money backstage. And no, that was my fee. I'm sorry. I'm mixing things up. So we went to work and we started looking at these images. And let me show you a couple of the products, all right? What this is a comparison between two identical frames. The one on the left is from the Pathfinder Panorama 80881. The one on the right is from our careful reconstruction, the adding of individual frames from the live video. And the reason we add the frames is that the noise is driven down by the square of the number of frames. So, you know, if you add up like 10 frames, you can drive the noise down by the square root of 10, which is roughly a factor of a little over 3. So you can actually improve on the television signal. Yes? Well, I knew this was hot, but I didn't think it was. Anyway, on the right, let me zoom in here. What you'll see are several very bizarre geometric features that came to our attention and were what really made Ron sit up and take notice. For instance, what's an old F-15 nose cone doing on Mars? I mean, this is a beautiful curved cylinder with a pointed nose, symmetrical, lying with a symmetrical thing here on the surface of Mars, up on this little hill beside the lander. Or, let me go over here, all right? Right here, there is a beautiful architectural block with material carved out, looking for all the world like some eroded cube with a very nice scallop. Now, down here, there is something which apparently is sitting on top of this version of a rock, which has a square base, a cone, and a thing on top symmetrical, and a bunch of right angle symmetries off to the left, looking very geometric. And let me move to another couple of things here before I show you the comparison. All right? This is one of my favorites, all right? This is one that Ron and I call the shark fin, which is a manifold. It's got an opening here. It's got an opening over here. It's obviously like a ductwork. And down here, there are several very regular geometric vents or holes, the same here. Now, this is obviously blurry because we're summing television, which doesn't have high res. But in fact, even at this resolution, the symmetries and the kind of geometry we're seeing, and let me show you the one that really intrigued Ron, it was this feature up here, which has protrusions. He calls this the starfish because it is so regular and looks like a starfish. Now, let me see if there's another feature here that kind of leaps out. Well, let me go over to the NASA version, all right? Because this was our control. On 80881, this same feature, all right? Remember this guy over here? Wrong thing. Okay. All right. This guy right here, all right? Now let's go look at his equivalent over here. This is now the official NASA version. Notice that it's even more pointy and more symmetrical and polished, and the sun is coming in here. All right, look at this little guy here, all right? There's a starfish. Look at that incredibly symmetrical pattern with shadows, all right? Has anybody ever seen a rock that looks like Gumby? Okay? Ah, yes, Martian rocks are different. No, you can't get away with that, all right? Because the guys looking at Martian rocks are terrestrial guys, and the only rocks they've ever seen are terrestrial rocks. So the way to play the game is you have to stick by the rules and say that, in fact, if it is on Mars, it has to follow the same kind of processes that we think we understand here on Earth. Here's my manifolding. Where is it? Right there. All right. There's the so-called shark fin. This is my name. Look, if they can call things Yogi and Scooby-Doo, I can name them other things. All right? The point is that when a trained geologist, Ron Nix, who'd been with Parsons and DOE and all that for 35 years, with experience mostly in dry desert geology, which is what Mars is supposed to be, when he looked at these, he got very, very perturbed, because to his trained eye, these geologies are simply not normal geological forms. They, in fact, looked more and more and more mechanical. They looked, in fact, like someone had set this spacecraft down in a junkyard. Now, here is that interesting kind of hollowed-out cube that we were talking about before, all right? And the resolution here, because this is digital, is somewhat better. Now, that brings me to a very important point. If you go back to the web, which we can do here, all right, and you look at the completely raw data, if you look at this mosaic in its most elemental form, all right, which, of course, is where we have not done anything to the web data except simply enlarge it, all right, here, this is raw. This is with nothing done to it. All right? Now, let me get down. See the pixels? I'm a little bit off axis here. Let me brighten this up so that you can maybe see this a little bit better. All right? Now, let's back down. All right? In other words, what we're seeing on this raw data is deliberately very under-res. And when this geologist, who has been Ron's colleague and friend, went to the website to try to begin to check on some of this, he found that this particular mosaic, this 80881, was even darker by several shades, probably a factor of 50%, from the form that Ron had stored when he downloaded it from the web several weeks before. In other words, once we did Pasadena, what NASA did was go back and basically compress the grayscale so they lost more information. They didn't change anything in this picture. They simply made it harder and harder to see. And you can literally see the two versions, one downloaded on like August 20th and the other one downloaded on like September, I think he was doing it around the 25th or 26th. The point is that even on the raw data, there are remarkable things that can be seen. For instance, this thing. Now, this thing is, I won't even get into what this thing is. This thing is deliberately mismangled. Now, let me show you something else that's bothersome about these pictures. Look at how the seams are not appropriately stitched together. Look at how this is duplicated, all right? Now, you can buy at Radio Shack for $50 a stitching program. Now, what this does to the casual observer is it gives him the impression he's seeing straight lines, yes, and then he automatically says, it's because the picture isn't quite put together, which means every other straight line and every other right angle and every other intensely geometric form is automatically dismissed as part of the incompetence of NASA. It's very, very sophisticated psychology. And it